Well, we survived our first real cold snap of the winter last week, but now things are much more livable, and that means it's time to get up and get outdoors. Today we're going to talk about some great winter activities that don't require a screen nor a power outlet. It's time to bring on the outdoor guys for the West Side Outside. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning on Ideas 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW. And as always, I'm pleased to welcome my cohorts and co-hosts for this hour. In studio is outdoor writer and creator of the hit TV show Northland Adventures, Dave Carlson. Welcome back, Dave.
Good morning on this frosty morning down here.
Good morning. And also, Also in studio is outdoor editor for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, Joe Knight. Welcome back, Joe.
Good morning. I'll try to create something before we're done.
Every week, I think you create something. Many times a week. Also, we've got some special guests this hour. For the first half of today's program, we're going to hear from Jim Bishop. Jim is a retired DNR communications specialist and winter camping enthusiast. He wears a lot more hats than that, but that's all I've got on the page. Jim Bishop, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Also, later this hour, we'll hear from Arlen Sturtz, cross-country ski instructor for the Kicking Kids Youth Ski Program and also the adult-oriented Ski Striders here in the Chippewa Valley. And we'll hear from Ben Popp, director of the Birkebeiner Ski Race, the biggest winter sporting event by far in Wisconsin. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. Be part of the program. The number is 1-800-228-5615. Tell us what you do when you're getting a little stir-crazy in the house. How do you get outdoors? How do you enjoy it? 800-228-5615. So, Jim Bishop, Dave Carlson really wanted to get you on the program badly to talk about winter camping. What drew you to trying, you know, camping is a great pastime, but what made you want to do it in the freezing cold?
I like camping anyway, spring, summer, fall, and winter camping was just another way of extending that activity. And I found that there's no bugs to deal with. There's no refrigeration. You can make up all your food ahead of time. All you've got to do is like wrap it in tin foil and throw it on a fire and heat it up, and you've got your meals. You can travel just about any place, cross-country skis, snowshoes across the frozen lakes, find a great campsite, and just hang out. I like ice fishing, so I generally camp near a lake. And I just came back from a four-day trip up in the Boundary Waters. We had a great trip, caught some fish, saw a lot of great scenery. It was just fun.
Jim, how do you get started? Where do you turn? Your backyard, campsites, where?
Best place to get started is like in a state or federal forest campground, some of these county forest campgrounds. I understand now that we've got almost 24 state park that allow and the forest state parks and forests that allow winter camping. They've got campsites open. This is a great way to start. Some place where you can pull up your car, bring your tent over, throw your gear in, and then if you get into trouble, and I got to stress this, the cold can get you into trouble really quick. If you get wet, if you get cold and start shivering, then you've got to get into someplace warm very quickly.
What kind of gear do you use, Jim? I've been with you everything from igloo, snow cave camping to out in the Boundary Waters, and I always study your gear. Just what kind of gear do you use?
Well, you've got to have gear to match the elements. And when I say match the elements, I actually start out with looking at about minus 30 below. My sleeping bag is minus 30 below. That's what it's rated for. I've been out with you, Dave, when we have seen temperatures that weren't supposed to get much below zero, and it's gotten way, way below that. So you have to have good sleeping gear. You have to have good clothing to match those types of elements.
Do you need any kind of a special tent or anything, or can my cheap Kmart, two-man tent work in the winter?
Well, you really don't even need a tent if you've got a good sleeping bag. Some of my first winter camping experiences were just out under the stars. If it looks like it's going to forecast for snow, all you need is a tarp over you to keep the snow off of you.
I got to say, this is a different picture than what I was imagining. This is pretty intense.
You also need a pad to go underneath you, though. That helps because your body weight will mat down the sleeping bag. So,
what about footwear, Jim?
Footwear, you've got to have a waterproof, heavy-duty insulated waterproof boot or a muckluck. I bring two along with me, two pair of boots. One a muckluck, very lightweight. Something that breathes, and then I bring along an insulated, waterproof boot with a liner that pulls out if it gets wet from my perspiration during the hike. I can pull it out and dry it off at night. It's got to be something that with a lot of insulation, and then of course the socks. You've got to have wool socks, and I'm saying wool, 70% or better wool. People say, well, maybe you need a wool liner or something. No, just get two good pair of socks and go with that. And then if you're going to go overnight, then you need an extra pair.
Now, I want to remind the listeners, we're talking about outdoor activities this winter. This is the West Side Outside. I'm joined by outdoor writers Joe Knight and Dave Carlson. On the phone with us is Jim Bishop. He's a retired DNR staffer and outdoor enthusiast. He is talking right now about winter camping. We're talking about gear. Are you a winter camper, or does that seem a bit far-fetched to you? Let us know what you think. 800-228-5615. We've got wide-open phone lines. I was looking at some quick tips and pointers today about winter camping, because I've never tried it, Jim. But one of the things they said was make sure your boots, you can take the insoles out so you can stuff them in the sleeping bag with you to keep them warm, because they said nothing worse than frozen boots in the morning. Is that being a little too comfy in your mind?
No, that's good advice. That's good advice. About anything that you bring into your sleeping bag at night will warm up because of your body warmth. These good old 98.6 degrees will dry things out at night. But then again, I got to caution you, you're kind of limiting yourself, because anything that gets absorbed, dried out, is also going to put a little moisture into that sleeping bag and then make that less effective.
So, generally,
a lot of my trips, I don't go for more than 3 or 4 nights because that sleeping bag starts to lose its insulation capabilities.
We don't want to get too technical here, but water is so important, hydrating. I can remember skiing in behind you or someone else onto one of those camping trips, and my water bottle, I had to keep it next to my chest under my shirt to keep it from freezing. Water is very important. It can be a killer, but it can also be a savior, right?
You're right. In the wintertime, the air is as dry as a desert, and your body is always losing moisture either through breathing or through just your activities. So, yeah, you're going to be drinking 2, 3, maybe even 4 quarts of water a day, and you've got to continually replenish that. And if not, you can get into trouble. You can start you're getting colder. Just everything that goes along with, lack of water.
Jim, I know you speak to a lot of school groups, to young people about this. Just how popular is winter camping? It's sometimes you look at activities and you don't see it turning the dial much, moving the needle. Is it getting more popular?
It's getting more and more popular, right. It's getting more popular. I know some of the state parks now are seeing a lot more winter campers, especially in the southern part of the state. I noticed that the only place now that you need a reservation is over at Copper Falls State Park over at Mellon. Camping is starting to get so popular, they're actually taking in reservations. And speaking of those state parks, I mean, it's a great time to get out and look at the waterfalls and the ice formations. It's a great time of the year to get out and do some of those activities.
That's wild. I just assumed that the state parks and the state camping grounds kind of close down in the winter time. So how do you find out which ones are open to winter camping? Just pick up the phone or look online?
Best thing to do is look online, right. Just Wisconsin State Parks, winter camping, will give you the list of what's open or what's closed, and what types of things are available. It's, for example, wood and water that you may have to bring if these things aren't available at those state parks. There's also federal forest lands. The Shawamigan and Nicolet National Forest all have campgrounds with winter camping. Most of your county forest lands and county parks offer winter camping too.
So you mentioned a good way to get started is to go to these campgrounds, have a vehicle nearby where you can jump in and you can go get warmed up somewhere. But when you're going to the boundary waters for a number of days, I imagine you're not packing in absolutely everything. I can't imagine you bringing in quarts and quarts and gallons of water on your back. Do you try to filter water? Do you boil snow? Or do you pack in your own water?
No, we when we're out in the boundary waters and in there's remote areas, we either melt snow or we drill a hole through the ice and take the water out, and then we boil it to provide water for us.
Wow.
Jim, tell us about I've seen you skiing or snowshoeing with towing a sled, too, and that when I think my winter camping days are behind me, but when I used to do it, I used to do it on skis with a backpack. But that sled idea looks a lot better than you don't have to be carrying the weight yourself.
Right. All my winter camping now, when I go into the outback, I take a big 4 or 5 foot sled simply because of the extra gear that's needed. And we tow just about everything. Generally have around 50, 60, maybe even 70 pounds of gear that we're pulling behind us. We've tried backpacks. They just seem to be too bulky, heavy, especially when you're hiking in 7, 8, 10, 12 miles back in.
One thing we should notice, too, this goes to all winter sports, but it's important how you dress. Like when you're, if you're skiing in somewhere for winter camping, you don't want to be wearing your big parka. You want to stuff this stuff, carry it on your sled or in your backpack, because all you need is a couple light layers, because you're going to be you're going to be working and you don't want to get too sweaty, because you're not going to have a jacuzzi to jump in when you get to your campsite.
Right.
So you pack your thick layers, kind of like if you have a long walk out to where you're going to go ice fishing too. You walk out with your jacket unzipped or on your sled, and then once you get down there and you start cooling down, then you start putting your layers back on.
Good advice.
That's a really good point, Joel, and we make it a point to have a place on our sleds to pack our parkas after the first quarter mile of hiking. We take off our parka, we put it on the sled, and then we're going to go another couple of miles, and we're going to be taking off the next layer as we start to warm up. Generally, by about mile 3 or mile 4, we're down to our shirts, even if it's below zero.
Jim, give us some pearls here. Quickest way to start a fire, best tasting food. Real quick fashion, give us some pearls from your experience.
Quickest way to start a fire is to bring some type of store-bought fire starter with you, and then put it under some small sticks, gather some small sticks, and then gradually get bigger. But put that fire starter under there and get that going, and you can get a fairly good fire going that way.
Energy foods.
Go ahead.
Energy foods.
Energy foods got to be high in fat, high in protein, something that's going to keep you going. Also, I'm a big chocolate lover, and I can eat chocolate 24/7. And the thing about being out there in the winter, you're using so much energy, either skiing or cutting firewood or fishing. No matter how much food I eat, I always lose weight on a winter camping trip. But make all your meals at home beforehand. You can make tinfoil dinners with burger and vegetables and pack them up and wrap them up in bacon, something that you can just throw on the fire wherever you're at, heat them up, and then eat them right out of your hand. Same thing in the morning when you've got make an egg dish or a quiche or something, wrap it up in tinfoil with bacon, and as soon as it warms up, you can eat it along with your coffee, your tea, or whatever you want to drink. And again, when you get up in the morning, you're going to be dry from sleeping all night long and exhaling all this nice moist air and breathing in dry air. You're going to need a lot of we generally drink a lot of coffee, a lot of teas in the morning to get us going. And once we've got that under our belt, we can make our way.
Now, that kind of makes me reminds me of another issue. What do you do if you wake up in the middle of the night, you're in the snow, you're tucked away nice and warm in your sleeping bag, and nature calls? What do you do? I've read that some people suggest maybe having a bottle in the tent, a special bottle.
Yes, and my buddies and I generally have our own little body and bottle, and it's very well marked. It's distinguished from our water bottle. But in my younger days, we did manage to crawl out of that sleeping bag in the cold of the night and put on our boots and go out and just do it. So. But now it's just a lot easier to grab that bottle and go.
And what about the other issues? I mean, do you have to? I was reading about cat scratch holes or something like that. I mean, do you have to pack in, say, toilet paper or anything like that? I mean, because you're out in the wilderness. If I'm at a campground, I might be able to go to one of the pit toilets or something like that. But don't get too personal. I mean, I don't want to know exactly what happens, but generally, do you bring in some toiletries?
You have to bring in the toilet paper, yeah, and then you go back in and you try to find a very low spot, and you, like you said, you dig something out with your heel, and then what I generally do is I try to cover it with as much dead trees and dead moss as possible. Because it will deteriorate us when the spring comes, and
sure,
most of the time no one will ever see it.
What's the longest you've ever gone winter camping?
It was a 4-day trip.
Okay.
And that a 4-night trip, 5 days, and that was up on a lake up next to the Canadian border last year.
The way Dave Carlson was explaining it to me, it sounded, I was under the impression that maybe you'd go up there for 3-4 months, something like that.
No, you go up nearly every month during the winter, don't you, Jim?
Yeah, we have generally a 2-3 night trip planned every month in the wintertime.
Wow.
And that's just up in the north. And in February, I've actually got 3 trips planned for the month.
You're hardcore.
That is hardcore.
How many toes do you have still, Jim?
Luckily, I've got them all. Wow. And that's another thing, too. A person's always got to respect the cold, respect it to the utmost, because once that body temperature starts dropping below 98.6, you've got to warm that thing up or you're going to be into trouble. In the summertime, you can get away with things, but in the wintertime, you've got to have extra plans, and that generally means always having an extra set of warm clothes, something that you can get into in case either through sweating or through rain or snow getting into your clothes, you get them wet. You've got to get dry, and you've got to get dry and warm quick. I also advise always going winter camping with a friend so you can check up on each other. If you go alone, make sure somebody knows where you're going and when you're expected back. So in case you get into trouble, you had somebody there to find you.
I just have one memory of winter camping when I used to be adventurous. I think we used to do it more for reasons of poverty maybe than adventure, but we went into the Yellowstone Geyser Basin once long ago in the winter, and it was spectacular. The algae changes color in the winter, and
wow,
the buffaloes all came down to be closer to the bisons, and there was no one around. I remember once me and my friend were having a peanut butter sandwich and Old Faithful went off. We were the only two people there to see it. You know?
Oh, great.
Compare
wow.
that to the summer when it's, you know, Elba to Elba. So.
That's amazing. So obviously the winter or the cold is the number one danger, but are there other dangers? Like, say, I mean, because a lot of this really warm clothing, windbreakers and whatnot, can be very, you know, flammable. Is that a concern?
Right. We recommend, if possible, to get away with all wool clothing and stay away from nylon, simply because if it gets too close to the fire, nylon will melt, and then you're out of a windbreaker or the pants can start on fire. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple pair of wool pants that I wear. I've got a parka that is nylon, but I'm very careful, especially when I'm around the fire, to not get too close.
I have a lot of melted nylon clothing that either got too close to a campfire or a wood stove. You know, when you come sure. in from skiing and there's a nice wood stove and you're wearing these fuzzy sweaters that are basically all recycled plastic, you can go
right.
warm yourself. And,
you know. You should be aware of ice conditions too, right, Jim? Thin ice between beneath a lot of snow, you can have a lot of slush, which that nothing slows down traffic quicker than slush or falling through the ice too.
Yeah, we had slush problems on our last trip, and when you go through the slush and the sleds and your skis get slush on them, you essentially it stops your forward progress. You have to pull the sleds over, push them over, chip all that ice off of there, because you literally cannot pull the sleds or ski when they're full of ice.
Mm-hmm.
It stops you dead.
Bottom line, Jim, what has winter camping brought into your life?
It's brought in kind of a new adventure. It has extended my range of fun, especially in the wintertime, like I said. It offers new challenges.
Yeah, I imagine it you learn something about yourself when you're really roughing it.
Yes, but I'm always amazed, especially on this last trip when we went up into the Boundary Waters. They've got like 2 to 3 feet of snow up there, and all that snow just kind of clung in big clumps to these black spruce. Hmm. It was such almost a magical place. It was so beautiful with, you know, just this, all this snow and this white, and we traveled in that for 3-4 days. It was just kind of a magical land, and it was just a lot of fun. And we caught fish. We saw a lot of new country.
Then you come home and take your grandkids to go see Frozen.
Well, Jim Bishop, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us the experiences that you've had winter camping. Definitely something that I have to try out eventually. I'm still getting used to actual summer camping, personally. And real quick, have you heard of the term glamping, glamour camping, Jim?
Oh, yes.
What do you think of that? Does it turn your nose up?
No, actually not. It's glamping is bringing along, essentially filling your truck full of as much warm gear and extra clothing and things that you can, and then unloading all that stuff into a nice warm, either a wood heated tent, and I've got a little wood heater that goes in my tent, and that at night, when you want to start 5 o'clock until we go to bed at 9, 10, 11 o'clock, we just keep feeding that fire, and we tell crazy stories around a campfire at night, and it's very comfortable in there. So glamping is comfort camping in the snow.
Right. Jim Bishop is a retired DNR communications specialist and a winter camping enthusiast, among other things. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We appreciate it very much. Now we're going to take our first break here on the west side. We're still joined by Joe Knight and Dave Carlson. We're also going to bring on Arlen Sturtz of Altoona, cross-country ski instructor, and we've got Ben Pop. He's the director of the Birkebeiner on the line. So stay tuned. This is the West Side Outside on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter Construction play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. Herman's Hermits, starring Peter Noon, come to Eau Claire to perform their hits from the 60s at the State Theater Thursday, February 25th. Tickets are available at EauClaireArts.com.
I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, the West Side. Actually, it's the West Side Outside today. I'm joined by outdoor writers Joe Knight. He's the outdoor editor for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. And Dave Carlson also joins us in studio. He's the host and creator of Northland Adventures, also a big-time outdoor writer. And joining us now in studio also is Arlen Sturtz. She is the cross-country ski instructor and enthusiast for a while with the cross-country skiing and lives in Altoona. Thanks for joining us, Arlen. We appreciate it.
Welcome.
Good to have you. And also joining us by phone, we've got Ben Pop on the line. Ben is the director of the Birkebeiner. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on the air. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. We're talking about cross-country skiing right now, all things cross-country skiing. 800-228-5615 to ask a question or a comment. We've got wide-open phone lines. What are the trails like in your neck of the woods? Is there plenty of snow? Would you like to see more? Etc. 800-228-5615. So, Arlen Sturtz, I want to talk first about, Joe mentioned the Kicking Kids program. So, if you could give us a rundown of what that is and what it entails.
Okay, it's a group that got started 21 years ago, and we had a handful of kids, and we now are up to around 130.
Okay.
And it's a progressive ski group. The kids come in at 4 years old, and as they progress, they move up to the next level and the next level. And we have four levels at the very beginning. And then we have intermediate, classic. We start them all in classic because then it's a little bit easier for them.
And what, I'm not an expert.
Okay, classic, so. Classic is in the track.
Okay, so you just.
And then they're skating, which is a flatted area.
Okay.
And they may work themselves up to that if they want.
And
I brought a prop here for.
Yes, for those listening on the radio, Joe brought a single cross country ski in here that is it is
show it to Arlen.
It is beat up.
She can guess where I skied last from looking at the bottom. I bet.
Oh yeah, Tower Ridge.
Okay.
We have a little leaf problem out there.
There are a bunch of leaves stuck to the wax on Joe's ski. So how do kids take to cross country skiing? Do they? I mean, they've got all the energy in the world, but. It's, what do they like about it?
Well, the secret is you have to keep them going. When they're 4 or 5 year olds, you don't let them stand still and give them instruction. You just keep moving, moving, moving. And kids like to move. I mean, they like to go, go, go. And so we just kind of keep them going as much as we can. And we start out with them not even in the track. We do a series of warm-ups always so they understand that. And they also have to always have mittens.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, they come with gloves, but mainly mittens and the hat. In fact, we give them a hat when they register. And they also pay if their registration fee is just like $20. That takes care of the insurance and the upkeep. And we start usually the first Monday in January, and we go for 8 weeks. We start at 4:30, and we finish at 6, and at 6 we have a little snack. It might be an orange, it might be an energy bar, or just some little thing. And we start at Chris Gorzik is the one who kind of got things started, and he kind of oversees everything. And now we have over 20 volunteers helping out with the program. But, for instance, the 5-year-olds, 4 or 5-year-olds, we start them. We do not use poles until toward the end of the season, maybe the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get out and we try to do the regular diagonal stride. We try to teach them how to go down a hill, come up a hill, turn on a hill if we can get them. And as they progress, they go up to the next level and next level. And now they can go up. We have them in the program till they're around 17.
Oh.
And they, after they've done the classic, which is in the track, then if they progress through the classic groups, they may start skating if they wish.
Hmm.
And then we have a beginning skating group, and we have an intermediate skating group. And then those who like to continue on, they will join. We also have a team. It's called the Chippewa Valley Nordic. Ted Therrell is in charge of that, and Sue Lindstedt works with that. And some of the kids...
That's a competitive team. They,
yeah,
they compete
yeah.
with other
yeah.
high schools around
yeah,
the state.
Yeah, they've been just, sure. in fact, this weekend they had a meet. We had a meet out at Tower last week.
Kid activities, there's plenty of them and much, much more at the American Birkebeiner. Ben Pop, director of that race. Can you tell me what's new this year, just what's going on, and when is the event held?
The event is held the last, well, typically near the end of February. This year, February 20th is the main event, but really it's a whole week of events. It's the youth events are on Friday. There's a fair amount of those. We have almost 1,500 kids that'll come up and ski. And so, Nordic skiing, that's one of the beauties of it, right? It's not generational. You can ski when you're 2 years old, you can ski when you're 20, you can ski when you're 70, and you can all do it together, and that's the beauty of the sport. And so the Birkebeiner, yeah, we're really, really fortunate to be able to have a series of events for everybody. You know, it's now over 13,000 skiers that'll come up that week, about another, 25,000 or so spectators. So it really is a great celebration of the Nordic skiing world and really something for everybody. So if you're looking for something to do at the end of February, make your trek up to Hayward and come join in the fun.
It sounds like an amazing, amazing experience. I've not even been, and I've lived up here.
Ben, I understand
life.
you changed the trail a little bit. You've been you wanted to talk briefly about
There's, go ahead.
So it's a little longer now, I understand. Thank you very much.
The Birkebeiner, the start of the Birkebeiner is going to be changing in 2017. For the longest time, it started at Telmark Resort, which, you know, many of you may know had gone bankrupt and closed. And so, fortunately, through some fundraising efforts, we were able to purchase a small piece of land from them and create a new start area. Hmm. It won't be ready till 2017, but what it does is actually shorten the overall course a bit, about 1 kilometer. So fortunately, we didn't want to short anybody. We were able to add 1 kilometer near the finish just before you go onto Lake Hayward. And so we were able to add that section this year. So you couple that with still using the old start, and it adds a kilometer to the event this year, which is now 51 kilometers for the skate or the freestyle that you were referring to earlier. And then there's also a classic version, which is actually on a whole separate trail, and that's 56 kilometers. So it's a long day in the woods for the many thousands out tromping through the woods, but it really is a spectacle and a good day to be outside.
What about the logistics in Hayward there? You had a bridge last year across 63. Any changes there?
You know, not a ton other than we're going to be utilizing a little bit different infrastructure in downtown this year. We have a great collaboration with the school district and use almost all of the schools. And this year we're going to be using a school that's a little bit closer to the finish line, only a block away, for all the skiers to be able to go inside and change their clothes and get their baggage after the ski. And so we're hoping that makes it a little bit easier for them and a little bit bigger area for all the participants to get food and stuff afterwards. And then, of course, there's all kinds of vendors downtown and the like that'll be new that come every year, everything from selling beer and broth to cheese curds, whatever you might want while you're watching 10,000 skiers come in. And the bridge, as you mentioned, that goes over Highway 63 will again be in place, which we did start last year as a way to try and alleviate some of the emergency vehicle issues that can happen with, you know, a small town of 1,500 gets inundated with 40,000 people. But other than that, there's not a huge amount of change this year other than, we're hoping for a little more snow on the ground and some cold weather to freeze up the lakes, and we'll be ready to go here in February.
Ben, did everyone make it over the bridge last year? I know that's kind of the last hill on the. You think you've reached? You've been skiing for you know, for all day long, and you get to a flat lake, and all of a sudden they've manufactured another hill for you going over the Highway 27.
Right. Yeah, everyone made it over just fine. In fact, so much so that we're going to have all the kids ski over it this year. You know, people were a little bit worried about it, but the reality is by the time you get to downtown Hayward, you've climbed almost 5,000 feet of elevation, so another 11 feet didn't affect people too much. It's a real gentle grade, too. It's only about a 3 or 4% grade up, and so it ended up being pretty easily navigated by most of the participants, even being totally exhausted. And like I mentioned, this year, a lot of the kids and youth really wanted to ski over it. They saw it, and of course, they love hills, as you were talking about earlier. And so we're going to give them the opportunity. We're going to start all the youth events on the lake this year so that they can, too, ski up and over the International Bridge and into downtown and experience that same feeling of a Berkey finish that that the other participants do.
Arlen, you're a skier, mm-hmm. a Berkey skier.
Yes, I did it for 20 years, and then now I just ski and have fun.
One of the founders from Eau Claire, yes. Carl Andresen. Joe, you knew him well.
Yes, and so did Arlen. They were, in fact, if Carl was the father of cross-country skiing in this area, I'd say Arlen was the mother of cross-country skiing.
Well, you know, Carl, he just keeps pushing you. You got to do it. Yeah. No, we did a lot together. In fact, he has been really very influential for our Eau Claire area skiing. He's the one that developed the trails out at Tower Ridge, and he's always been a backer. If you come out to our cabin at Tower Ridge, you'll see his picture and a little tribute to him. He was one of our leaders.
Founders usually kick the race off, don't they, Ben? They lead the pack. And how many are you going to have this year?
Yeah, you know, so this year we have two remaining founders, and one of them that actually, Ernie St. Germain, has skied every event since 1973. He's the last one that have done all of them. And so he'll be here. And then we have what's called the Spirit of 35. And those are the 35 skiers that have skied the most Berkeys, anywhere at this point, about 37 or 38 of them. And we choose them to represent that original 35 skiers that were there to originally kicked off the Berkey on Lake Hayward back in 73. And so they start the race. Yeah, they get to go off before everybody about 7:45. And the rest of the waves that start around 8, and so it's a nice ceremony to really honor them. I mean, the Berkey, obviously, there's a whole lot of skiing involved, but a lot of it is the history and tradition that really remains so strong, and so it's really a fun time to be able to honor them and call them all out and remember why we're all still standing here, that, boy, a long time ago, people were brave enough. They strapped on their skis not really knowing where they were going to go, into the woods towards a place called Telmark, and here we are, 43 years later, and still doing it.
With that, let's take our final break here. We're talking about cross-country skiing, whether it be at the in the Berkey Banner or at your local trails, 800-228-5615. I know we've got some listeners out there who love cross-country skiing, so if you'd like, give us a call at 800-228-5615. Tell us your favorite trails. Tell us some of your stories of competing in the Berkey, if you have. I'm sure you've got some. This is the West Side. I'm joined right now in studio by Joe Knight and Dave Carlson, the outdoor guys. Arlen Sturtz is in the studio as well, and we've got Ben Pop, director of the Berkey Banner, on the phone. We'll be back in just a bit.
When you're online, visit WPR.org. You'll find news headlines from WPR and NPR and feature stories about arts, culture, music, and politics. Explore our live audio streams, links to program information, or check out upcoming events in your area. WPR.org. We're not just on your radio.
Support for WPR comes from Hooper Corporation, supplying custom construction services, including electric power, mechanical, and green technology to commercial, industrial, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913. Support also comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, offering events about maintaining heart health during February Heart Awareness Month. Details are on the Calendar of Events webpage at mayoclinichealthsystem.org.
This is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. I'm Rich Kramer. Joining me, in studio, We've got Joe Knight of the Eau Claire Leader Telegram and Dave Carlson of Northland Adventures. On the phone, we've got Ben Popp. He's director of the Birkebeiner. Also in studio with us is Arlen Sturtz, cross-country ski instructor and longtime cross-country ski lover. 800-228-5615. We're starting to get some calls right now. Before we take them, I want to go back to Arlen very quickly. What does it take to get into cross-country skiing? I remember very young, my mom found some skis, cheap skis, the old kind with the rubber off the end of the boot and the clamps. Now everything's so fancy and expensive. Is there a way to get into it on the cheap?
I tell you, if you go to Spring Street Sport, for our kids, they have an exchange program. If you have a 5- or 4-year-old, you can go there. You'll get skis, poles, boots. You buy them. You pay a fee, and next year you bring them back when the kids' boots don't fit. They give you another pair of boots.
Nice.
So that these kids can
I imagine work in for that. Kids that keep growing, that can get expensive.
No, and some of the flat skis, like you were just saying, you can do that if you want to just shuffle around. But now the bindings let you raise your foot up a little
yeah.
more.
Yeah, all the equipment. When I had those, my mom would take me to the ski shop and mm-hmm. and looking at all the new equipment, I was so jealous. They were so much thinner, the skis, too.
Yes, they are.
And at Spring Street Sports, that's in Chippewa Falls
yes.
for folks that are outside of our immediate area. And we've got a caller on the line. We've got, and this is, let's see here, Jack. Jack and Eau Claire, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind, Jack?
Yes, I just wanted to take a minute and remember Carl Andreessen, one of the founders of the Birkebeiner, who passed away just earlier this month. One of his many, many friends. I can't believe how many people whose lives he's touched, but I did want to, I didn't know if you folks had mentioned him yet today or not, but quite a character.
We did just speak with him, but it sounds like his legacy is a long and illustrious one. I never met the man, but
he was a co-worker of Mort out there who was fielding the phone calls.
Oh,
he
was
in the political science department for many years. Yeah.
Interesting.
Quite well known for his teaching ability. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Jack. And
got another caller, too?
No. We lost one on the way here.
Oh, you did.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
I should, as a testimonial, I say I used to live when I lived out near Lake Altoona, and I lived close to Carl, too, and he
okay.
I think he's one of the reasons that I became, well, I already sort of cross-country skied, but then when I got to Eau Claire and met the Striders, then I learned quite a bit more about
sure.
it and got a lot more involved in the sport.
Before we talk about the Striders, I want to find out what it's like to compete in the Birkie. I mean, that sounds like a long trek, 5,000 feet of elevation, whether or not it's a steep incline or not. Arlen's
being modest, but when she used to ski 100 years ago, was it Arlen?
Yeah, about 100.
Do the race, she was one of the top female citizen
really?
Skiers.
Yeah. What's the best place you ever
well,
you got?
In my age group, I
sure.
could take first. What happened is I started out in the classic in the track, and then skating came in.
Mm-hmm.
So then I picked that up. A lot of my cohorts didn't pick up the skating because it was harder. So
sure.
I kind of had an in.
And you can go way faster
skating.
When you're skating.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I did it for 20 years, and that was enough.
And Joe, what's it like when you get towards the finish line? I mean, are you pretty well pooped?
Yeah, I am. I don't train enough. But but that's the main reason for signing up for this thing, that it makes me get over to the Y or get out skiing more than I would if I had not signed up. But it's fun for me. I'm not competitive. I'm a middle-of-the-packer.
Sure.
I enjoy skiing through the woods. It's lovely till about 45K, and then it all starts catching up to you. You come to a place they call a bitch hill. And usually handing out energy drinks there is Jim Bishop, who we just talked to.
Oh,
and,
really?
So I can stop there and talk about ice fishing maybe as I down a couple of Gatorades. And then from then on, it's pretty extreme. Yeah.
It's full circle. I'm not sure if we can say that on the air, but we already did, so we apologize for that.
Hey, Ben, what about ski jouring? Do you still have those races with the dogs?
Oh, that's got to be great.
Yeah, we do. The ski jouring is really popular, the bark of Birkie, we call it. And it is really, it's one of the more popular events, and it's the people get out there with the man's best friend, right, and it's so fast because the dog's pulling you along, and other times it's tiny, tiny little dogs, and you pick it up and carry it, or so it seems sometimes, but it is really popular, and And just wanted to add in a little bit about the event in terms of the tenacity it takes. And having grown up in Phillips, not far from the Berkey here, I started skiing my first Barna Berkey when I was 4 and have skied the Berkey 17 or 18 times myself. And it really, the fun part is that there, it's everybody's personal goal to get to the finish. And of course, some of the elite guys are trying to do it in 2 hours. And there's others out there for 8 hours, and they're the ones that are just amazing, that have the fortitude to know they're leaving the start line and are going to spend breakfast, lunch, and dinner out on the course and still make it to the finish line. And I think it really is truly that testament to a year-round of, I like to think of it as a Berkey lifestyle, right, that you're thinking about going to the Y, or, boy, I better go out for a run or do some push-ups because, man, there's a lot of Berkey Hills out there, and I got to get ready. So I agree that it really is an unbelievably difficult effort, but it's also an amazingly rewarding one. I think most people would tell you that when you get down to Main Street, you hear the church bells ringing and hear everybody clapping, and that warm bowl of soup at the end is awfully tasty.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And I'm used to, you know, I lived in Superior, so the Grandma's Marathon in Duluth was a big thing.
Oh, sure.
And I'm just wondering, you know, at the end of the marathon, it was a big party. Is it similar situation after people get done with their day-long ski?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, in fact, I think that's a big reason a lot of people want to make it to Hayward is for the party. It's you know, it really is a celebration that I just made this huge trek across hill and dale to get to Hayward, and all your loved ones are there celebrating. There's all the town folks, and then people now, like I said, we probably have to 25 or 30,000 people that will come just to spectate, friends and family, and people to just watch it. And so you get to the end, and either you head to your favorite saloon, or you're out there cheering on other people that are finishing. But it's a huge party once you get to Hayward, and everyone's just very excited to be here. And so, yeah, you got to come check it out and see how it rivals Grandma's in the summertime.
We've got what will probably be our final call of the morning here. We're going to hear from Christy in Chippewa Falls. Christy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to mention Hickory Hills, the ski trails, and their awesome new snowshoe trails.
Mm.
Dave Landgraf was one of the main promoters there. And then Mike Dalby with the Chippewa County also does a lot of promotions. And there are two parking lots, north and south end, and there's a nice rustic cabin on the north end that is available for public use, but it's a fabulous area.
Great. Hickory Hills.
It's a lovely, I'll second that. Yeah, it's lovely terrain. It goes through the glacial hills there, and you go pass by, it seems like a dozen frozen little frozen lakes.
Yeah. Nice.
It's so nice.
Very good. Christy, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 800-228-5615. We probably don't have time for another question, but a quick comment, we can do that. So tell me about the Ski Striders, Arlen Sturtz, real quick before the end of the program, then we'll round out some more Berkey talk here, but that's for adults, I would imagine.
Yes, it is, and, well, families, and we were instrumental in getting the cabin out at Tower Ridge, mm-hmm. and the Striders was also started by Carl Andreessen, wow. of course, and they... our idea is to promote skiing. We do a lot. Like yesterday, we had an open house out there. We had free skiing. We gave free ski lessons. We have free adult ski lessons coming up in February on the 1st and the 8th at 6:15. Anybody can come out. You have to have your own equipment. But if you need to rent, Spring Street will always rent it to you, and they'll get you set up for it.
Sure. So. And what kind of area can you pull from? I mean, how far can people...
Oh, all over. It's surprising on Monday nights where they come from. They may come from Aliva, Strum, Menominee, Chippewa. Yeah, we have. And our Nordic group has from most of the high schools in the area, like Chi High. And
very cool.
And
speaking of pulling from outlying areas, Ben Pop, some of these people that compete, some of the people that come to visit the Berkey, we're talking a worldwide draw, aren't we?
Yeah, you know, it's really neat. We normally have people represented from at least 45 to 48 states in the U.S. We always get the folks coming from Hawaii or California or Georgia, Alabama that say, oh, it's my cold turkey Berkey, if you will. It's my one time of the year on skis. And so it really is a national draw. And this year, I think we have 23 countries represented. And the Birkebeiner is part of a bigger series of races called the World Lopet, which Tony Wise, the Berkey founder, also created. And the theory of the World Moped was to create opportunities for people to travel the world through the medium of skiing. And so you can go to France or Iceland or Argentina or China, Sweden, Norway, all of these places and do a World Moped race. And so being a part of that series, we get people that come from all over the world to come experience what it's like to ski and just, of course, experience the culture of northern Wisconsin and what it's like to be in the U.S. And so it really is fun to be on the start line and hear all the different languages being spoken, and it's really a treat for sure.
Yeah, I know you're a busy guy, Ben. Thanks for taking some time this morning to talk to us. That's awesome. Wish you the best for another Berkey.
Thank you much.
Is the Barker Bernie filled up yet? I have an English setter who's getting kind of bored. And I don't
No, I think we have a couple spots left. You better register soon, and we'll see you up here in the Northwoods.
Okay. Thanks, Ben.
All right, thanks, Ben. That's Ben Popp. He's the director of the American Birkebeiner. We appreciate him being with us. We've got literally a minute and a half. Last words. What's the motivation? What should people... what's the fire that you should light underneath them, Arlen, to get on some skis or get out camping?
It's just fun. It's a camaraderie. It's fun. It's a lot of people don't like winter, and it's because they don't do things. You get out there, it's just really fun. You meet a lot of people, and it's good exercise. It's one of the best exercises
for
you because it uses the whole body.
Ben and Jim both touched on it. It's wellness, and it's a lifestyle.
That's right.
Is what it's all about. It's a culmination, and for some, you're addicted to it, you know.
It's fun. Yeah. Exercise. I'm not real big at going to the gym and pumping iron, but skiing, the good part is you don't know you're getting the exercise. You're just going up and down the hills and sliding right along. So,
well, I imagine that after 40-some kilometers, you know you're getting the exercise.
Yeah, that's an extreme case. You don't have to do that. That's just if you're
but
twisted.
The other thing is you're always trying to improve.
Yeah, right.
There's always a challenge out there. It's not
competing with yourself.
Yes, right. It's never the same.
All right. Well, thank you to all my guests, the outdoor guys, Arlen Sturtz, Ben Popp, Jim Bishop. It was a great discussion this hour. And next week, we're going to be talking about changes at churches as far as trends in attendance, what age groups are going. It's going to be an interesting discussion. That's Monday morning at 10 o'clock next week. Until then, have a safe and productive week. I'm Rich Kramer. We'll chat again.